Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by a full table of fellows from the 1517 Thinking Fellowship. I'm joined by Drs. Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, Rod Rosenblatt, and Dan Van Voris. We are doing as promised, because I've been actually hyping this up for the last 3 or 4 weeks on the Thinking Fellows, and today we're going to do our first episode on the history of Christianity in America. Dan actually reached out to me with this idea, and I thought it was sort of a great follow-up to what we did in the Reformation series. We are skipping a little bit of a chunk of time, because we're moving from Europe over to the New World, so to speak.
You'd be surprised how little time we're actually skipping ahead.
That's great.
When you put everything back and back, all of a sudden you start to realize that people were working at the same time, and we did the Reformation story, and the Reformation story we took up to, you know, you can take to 1618, right, the beginning of the 30 Years' War. Well, in 1620, you've got the first guys on the ship over to the New World. So, and they're leaving because of what's happening with, at that time, King James and the turmoil in England. So it really is interesting how the Reformation story and then the story of America, you'd think, yeah, there's this, you know, maybe the Enlightenment took place
there's
between them.
There's at least an ocean between them.
But that's happening, yeah, concurrently. So it's it kind of does fit right on.
We get a lot of questions about this. Topic. Actually, we get a lot of questions from Lutherans who are sort of like, why do we seem like we don't have a lot of voice in the States and things mm-hmm. like that? And so I think it's gonna be a really good one. And we've never done anything like this on the show. We've done a lot of Reformation stuff, so it's gonna be exciting. But before we open the episode up, there's a couple things to talk about. Number one, Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 podcast network. There's a lot of great shows on the network. One of them that you should go check out is Dan Van Voris' Christian History Almanac. It's a great everyday show. It's literally 7 days a week. It's 5 minutes. It's a great little couple stories in history, and then a nice piece of prose or poetry or hymnody to close out the episodes. It's fun. It's relaxing. I think everybody should go check it out. And we have a couple other new shows on there as well. Again, 1517.org/podcast. And then the other big piece of news here is we have less than 100 tickets left for the Here We Still Stand conference down in San Diego that 1517 puts on every year. If you want to join us, if you're a listener on the podcast network, you can actually get $25 off your ticket there. Use code PNET19, Podcast Network 19 is what that stands for. And I'll put that code in the show notes in the link to the Here We Still Stand registration page. Again, there's less than 100 tickets left to that. We're going to sell out pretty quickly here. So if you do want to join us in San Diego, I suggest using that code. That's the only way at this point to get that $25 off. And I think the price will go up here in the middle of the summer at some point. So if you're sort of on the fence, now's a good time to talk about it and decide. All right. So we're just going to jump in to the episode here. And Dan, I just want to ask, where are we supposed to start here? Where do we start with Christianity in America?
Well, you know, thanks. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on the show again. And, you know, in terms of going through this look at Christianity in America, I broke it down into 6 parts. And so if we just want to look kind of thematically at the very beginning, we're going to look at it in 6 different parts. We're going to look at the colonies. So think the 1600s into the 1700s. Then we're going to look at the founding generation. And so the end of the 18th century, questions about the faith of the founding fathers, right? That's going to be second. Yep. And then as well as how the Constitution works into that. Then we'll move into looking at the Great Awakenings, rationalism and revivalism in the late 17 and 1800s. We'll move into, from there, the fundamentalism modernism in the 20th century with Machen and some stuff that I've actually talked about on this show before. And then the last one, we'll look at all of the modern stuff that's happening. People always have questions about the emergent church or the postmodern or the post-church church or all these phrases.
And if we run out of time on that.
If we run out of time.
That'll get cut.
But I am happy, Rod, as you know, having been your student, I'm happy to dive into the deep waters of deep evangelicalism and, come out with some words for you guys. But that's, so kind of looking at it, thematically. And as I mentioned before, I think the best way to start is not to say, well, the Reformation happened and then there's a gap. You know, oftentimes this is how it'll be done in school books. You'll do the Enlightenment and you'll go over and do that. And then by the time you get back to American history, you just assume 100 years has gone by. Well, no.
I always do.
Yeah. And when you look at, you know, really 1620 and 1630 are the two banner years when you have the Mayflower and the Arbella come over. And so in 16, those are the first, you know, Puritans, the first pilgrims. And it, what's interesting is that's, I wrote this down. There are 2,000 Americans, or 2,000 colonists, I should say, in 1630.
Can we call them Americans?
We can call them Americans, yeah, so early Americans. And it, when all this is happening, right, because of the Reformation. So remember that in England, you had Henry, Edward, Mary, Elizabeth, James, and every time they're switching, it's a new confession of faith and there's blood in the streets. So you could see some people would say, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
Now, the first group actually got out of there well before that. The pilgrims from Plymouth actually had already gone up to the Netherlands and were living there. When they decided to come to the New World, they came back to Plymouth, got a royal charter, and made their way over.
Hmm.
And that's an interesting group because they are coming for religious reasons.
Which is the thing we always hear in school, right?
Yeah.
If I think about it, I hear about, you know,
the pilgrimage,
yeah.
Pilgrims
yeah.
fleeing religious oppression.
Because yeah. they love God and they want freedom. Yeah.
yeah. Well, it's, there's so many different people that are coming over. And so it's fair to say in the 1620s, the people that are coming over are by and large religious refugees.
Okay.
By and large, they are either Puritans or we might just use the broad word separatists. And the separatists meant, you know, the Puritans who wanted to reform the church more. It meant, you know, the Mennonites. It meant the Quakers. Basically, anyone who wasn't at that time a part of the High Anglican Church, because
okay.
they had moved to High Anglican. So in that era, that's the first 2,000 colonists, and they've got various, very strong religious views. Adam, I know we've taught a similar class at Concordia where we had our students read A Model of Christian Charity, which is kind of the big text. If you're looking for the Ur text of American religious history, you want to go to A Model of Christian Charity. And it's a speech. It's 2 pages long. Mm. And in that, you have a very clear, hey, this is why we're coming to America. This is why we're coming to the New World. And this is what we plan on doing. For a historian, nothing is better than someone saying, here are our intentions.
Yep.
And that's the famous phrase about the America or the New World will be a light shining on a hill comes from,
yeah.
obviously, Matthew 5, but that letter on the Arbella. So in terms of saying, yeah, this was these were Christian pilgrims, absolutely. But let's go back to those numbers. There were 2,000 in 1625. By 1660, right? So you're just looking at 35 years, there are 100,000 people who have come to the New World.
That's a big jump.
To 100,000. In just 30 years, you have 250,000. 50 years after that, you're a 1 million, such that in 1775, the end of the colonies, you have 2.5 million. So you've gone in, what would that be? That would be 150 years. You've gone from 2,000 people
yep.
to 2.5 million. Now, I can tell you about the religious inclinations and beliefs of 2,000 people pretty well.
Uh-huh.
100,000, harder. 2.5 million, almost useless to do. So it's not to say it's, you know, not to be cynical and say we can't know anything, but it's just to say there are so many people with so many different beliefs that it wasn't a bunch of people walking arm in arm confessing the Westminster Catechism or something, you know,
right.
as much as we might think of that. Now, at the same time, there are leaders, and the leaders are going to be important, and we'll talk a little bit more about the Founding Fathers on the next show. But, you know, were the colonies set up for a Christian reason? Yes, initially.
Mm-hmm.
And then it grows.
Especially up in New England. What about like Jamestown? That's more Anglican, sort of mainstream Anglican.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, oftentimes one of the easiest ways you can do it is you look at the name and then see if it corresponds to that king,
oh,
what
Jamestown,
their confession
yeah.
of faith is. Yeah, so Jamestown, Maryland, which is not Queen Mary, but is King Charles, Catholic King Charles' Spanish wife.
Mm-hmm.
So Maryland, oh. Spanish Catholic.
Yeah.
You can kind of, you know, Virginia is... it's the Virgin Queen, which was
Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth. Yeah.
yeah.
So, and she was Protestant. So it is, yeah, you can look at the different colonies.
Odd, like in the Plymouth colony, or I'm sorry, Massachusetts Bay Colony, 1630. Yeah. Out of that colony, you get Roger Williams.
Yeah.
Who goes up to Rhode or Rogue Island.
Yeah.
He's quirkier than these Puritans.
Yeah. Roger Williams is one of these guys who says, oh, a land of religious freedom?
Uh-huh.
I'm there.
Uh-huh.
And they say, hold on a second. We didn't mean that. And that's, you know.
Roger Williams, he's the radical, at least at that time period. The interesting thing is it's his ideas that probably have the
more influence on America than
our notion of church and state more than any other of the earliest.
Absolutely. Roger Williams, famous for a couple things. He, you know, the idea of a hedge instead of a wall between the church and state to protect the church from the state.
Right.
That's much more how we would come to talk.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, a light shining on a hill, not, I mean, especially as Lutherans, we all shiver, but that's, you know, not quite the same thing.
This is off topic, but I think today you can see that most people interpret the separation of church and state as protecting the state from the church.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
Roger Williams, interestingly, it was him and a woman, Anne Hutchinson. And they were you know, booted out of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And what were they booted out for? The official charge? Antinomianism.
Oh, my Lord.
And why did they say antinomianism? It had very little to do with what they were actually teaching, but that was a charge that stuck.
That's sometimes the case.
I've never heard that happen before.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a great, in German McCulloch's book, Christianity, big...
The first 3,000 years or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's got this great line about how Christians seem to always go after the boogeyman of antinomianism whenever they need to go after somebody.
Oh, interesting.
I think that's a defensible thesis.
I know. That's what we, sure. Yeah.
Yep.
Certainly experienced.
I think anyone who is well preaching Christ sola fide, the charge will come to him.
Yeah. Who was it that said that? There was a Presbyterian minister, wasn't it, who said, you should always be accused of being an antinomian.
Yes.
If you're preaching the gospel.
Yes.
It's one of those older guys, like not J.I. Packer, but that same kind of generation. You have Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson, so they go to Rhode Island. And that was kind of the beginning of the difference between, to give another idea here, religious liberty versus religious toleration. And this is a big difference, because while all of this is happening in the 1630s and 1640s, the 30 Years' War is going on, 1618 to 1648. There's not the internet or fast mail, but they see what's going on.
Yeah.
And they see
the consequences.
There's got to be a new way of doing it.
Yeah.
Now, the old model was religious toleration. That is, the state has a religion, and they will tolerate people doing other things in certain places.
As long as. Dot, dot, dot.
Exactly. Whereas religious liberty is probably what we think of today, right?
Practice what you want.
Practice to worship how you want. And so that kind of started this new model. And so you've got Rhode Island, and then the next place to kind of blow up on that same model would be Pennsylvania and the Quakers and William Penn. Mm. He comes over and follows. He's kind of the first one to follow in that tradition of religious liberty. You can do what you will. And then you've got some of the first Lutherans are going to come into the kind of Delaware River into Pennsylvania, and they're going to set up there. So that becomes kind of the cauldron of this new experiment in religious liberty, which has not been tried before. I mean, it really is a fascinating thing. And surprisingly, it worked pretty well. If you look at the people who have this different confession living together, well, at the exact same time, people of a different confession living in Europe, and they're killing each other.
Mm.
And over here under a different model, not perfect, but, you know, it's a noble experiment.
Does this tie into, like, why we see laws, like being on the West Coast, it appears less laws seem to have religious background?
Fewer blue laws.
And I think most of it probably is alcohol. Like where and when and how it can be sold and things like that.
Yeah.
I've been to Pennsylvania a couple times, and my in-laws were from there, and they came to California, and my mother-in-law was surprised where you could buy alcohol.
Yeah.
Out here and things like that.
Yeah. Blue laws are interesting, and they do go back, and the blue law is a reference to the Puritans who would wear sort of blue ribbons, or they have a blue ribbon. So it was the blue law. It was a Puritan law. Interestingly, most of them went away, and the drinking ones came back during after Prohibition. Yeah. Sure. Because when the government gets some power, right, and they have the ability, oh, okay, we'll give it back to you, but we'll give it back to you.
Well, yeah, and they negotiated the return of Prohibition the overturning of Prohibition under certain circumstances. It's crazy.
It's a wild story, but in terms of the, you know, places being closed on Sunday and other places, that comes right out of this background of, I think, an uneasy understanding of church and state, and one that doesn't really reflect that much the founders, but seems to really reflect the people on the ground, because that's just what happened. That's just kind of what occurred. People wanted, you know, their state to be godly. Yep. They wanted their commonwealth to be godly. And so you'd try and outdo, you know, and it's basically what people do, but on a statewide basis, a colony-wide basis.
So you talked about lots of, like sort of a difference religiously between a lot of the people and the growth here and the leaders.
Yeah.
What does church attendance then look like?
This to me is fascinating. So we'll see if it's actually fascinating. But whenever you look into church history in America and the colonies in the 17th and 18th century, you always find this curious thing that church membership is about 30%. Church membership is as low as it's ever been in American history in the colonies and early America.
Why is that?
Well, I've been searching for this forever. Why is that the case? And so people have suggested some things like they weren't actually as religious. They were just feigning religious reasons and got over here. And
it's a way to get out. Thing.
Yeah, exactly. Just, yeah, it's like a
me
kid.
Too. I believe that too.
I need that day off too.
Kind of like Prohibition again. You know? I think they enrolled, more people were called rabbi during Prohibition than any other time in the United States history because they could buy wine.
There you go. But what I've sort of come to in looking at different numbers, I think what we've got to distinguish is church membership versus church attendance.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that these early Puritans, they were fascinated with the idea of covenant. Now, you know, this is going to come right out of their theology, right? This the covenant theology, not only is their way of looking at scripture, but it's their way of interacting with one another. And they believe that they have these various godly covenants. With regard to church membership, to be a member, you had to be able to stand up in front of the congregation and say things like when you had your conversion experience.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right? You had to have these things. And so you'd go under church discipline, which was, you know, as hard as anything. So it would be much more convenient to not become a church member and simply go. Because then you'd stay away from, you know, some of the things. I mean, it was really an interesting... Mm-hmm. So church attendance, everyone went to church. Now also, the churches tended to be owned by the states themselves. And in the states themselves, the church property would be more almost as civic as religious. Mm. So you go to church on Sunday because that's where you'd see people. That's where you know you could get in touch with that guy or that guy and you're doing business. So attendance was super high, higher than it's ever been. But membership as low as it's ever been.
Wow.
And I think that's an interesting, it just tells you, you know, you look at, who's the president, James Polk, you know, Eisenhower never became a member of a church until he finally became president.
Right.
James Polk was baptized on his deathbed. You know, you have all these interesting, today it seems everyone's a Christian and no one goes to church and no one's a member. Yeah. You know, it's the exact opposite. Back then, everyone went to church. And if you didn't believe, you just kept it quiet. If you were a deist and there wasn't a Unitarian church in your, and that usually wasn't, you'd keep quiet. Because although they said religious liberty, some of the Unitarians were pushing it for some of the people. So it depends where you lived as well.
The networking aspect of that has definitely not left us.
No, absolutely. And this goes back to the Middle Ages. I mean, the church in old towns, if you go to the center of the town, it's the church. And outside that, usually the graveyard, because this is the center of everything. And they believed in many ways that the altar was, you know, actually emanated grace, at least in the Middle Ages, right? So you'd want that as central as anything.
You want to be as close to it as possible, too.
Absolutely, yeah. Great stories. I mean, not great stories, but stories about, what do we call them? Women of the night who would wait outside of churches because that's where they knew people were going to be coming out of, you know? And this is sort of late medieval, and this is, you know, part of a world we don't understand, but... you know, when you want to look at some of the corruption of the church, that's always something that's pointed out.
There's a historian named Graham Wood. I think he's a liberal Anglican or something like that. But he's got a book called A Short History of Secularism. And he argues, it's really interesting, he says these folks around complaining about the decline of the church today, he argues that's only because we compare today's numbers to the really high numbers in the Victorian era. If you look at the long view of church history, through the Middle Ages back to the earliest church, church attendance, church membership, relatively low. Like the numbers, church attendance today is about, percentage-wise, about the same as it was in the Middle Ages.
I think the same thing all the time within Lutheranism, where I think we have people that are still alive that remember what attendance was like in, say, the 50s and the 60s and sort of the heyday of denominational Christianity in America. And they look back on it, and we think that there's a lot of decline. One of the ways I'll say this when I go out and teach is that you're witnessing a lot of mainline denominational decline. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's a ton of evidence for a great decline in the number of Christians. Mm-hmm. Some people think it's coming, but...
up until recently, you essentially had to be a Christian for many things, right?
Yeah.
Whether it was public life. I mean, Kennedy was a Catholic, and that was big news. And so I think it used to be that even if you didn't believe, you went on Sunday in the 50s and 60s to show you weren't a communist, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was... very much kind of the social club. If that's going away as a Christian, I don't mind. I can, all right.
Right. Yeah, I don't mind either, but I do think it's a reason for decline.
Yeah, so people say, the numbers are so low.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell. In the 50s, when we look at church membership, and just as this early American and early colonial thing shows us, when we start looking at membership versus attendance, it's really difficult for the historian to say, this is how many people are going to church, right, let alone this is how many people actually believed.
Yep.
Oh, heaven. That's just not what we do.
Yeah, good luck.
But it's very helpful for modern, prophets of doom to just, let's see. Oh, yes, everything's going to hell. Everything's falling. Everything's numbers are going down. Well, that's a way of looking at it, I guess, but it's hard to compare it to something.
I think in Ben Shapiro's interview of William Lane Craig a couple weeks ago, he talks about how the middle is emptying out, whereas the evangelical and sort of a classic sense of the term, they're all sticking around. But those who are part of these big denominations, they're either going to evangelicalism or they're going to... Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so. I don't shed a single tear over mainline hemorrhaging. I don't.
Yeah.
I mean...
That's surprising.
Yeah, there's nothing going on anyway that has any sort of salvific character to it. Why should I...
Well, there's the question, why should I go?
Yeah.
And at least if you, back in these days, you had the cultural reasons, the civic reasons, and really what we're concerned, you should go because you need to hear the gospel.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so if all those other things, go.
But we're a very small voice on that in American Christianity. You should go to hear the gospel.
It is much, and we'll see this as we look through the history, right? We'll see that much of this kind of individualistic, very church as a therapeutic place or a place where better families are made.
Yep.
We're going to see that, especially in Session 5, because we're going to get to the West Coast and we're going to talk about the growth of Calvary Chapel and Saddleback Church and that, which I think, Scott, really affects the way we look at church and church size. Because there are churches, an average church is, 50 people, 80 people?
Yeah. 50 to 100.
But we're used to seeing, these churches with thousands, and we're told that's the way it's to be done.
Yeah. Okay. There's some argument. There's a lot of good arguments for churches ought to be smaller, or small enough for the pastor to know everybody's name type thing. And I think that we don't measure the quote-unquote success of a church on things like that, Is the gospel being preached? Are the sacraments being administered? We only measure it on a comparative basis to what we see elsewhere.
Yeah.
And that is dangerous. Although I will say it's sometimes, as I travel and speak, it's sometimes terrifying in a bit of a way to walk into church after church after church that is probably 100 people on a Sunday, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But you can tell the church was built to hold 500.
Yeah.
And that the 100 people that are on Sunday, the average age is 72.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is a little, it, you know, it, it's hard to not be emotionally affected by that when you see it. Even if you can cognitively go, oh, well, these people are probably going somewhere else or da da da. And I just saw somebody on the old Facey page the other day sort of describe what I thought was well known, just that most of the Saddleback Calvary Chapel type churches have on the whole not converted people to Christianity, but have simply provided a place for people that are coming out of mainline denominations to land.
Yeah, that it's either at worst maybe just shuffling the chairs, and at best maybe taking some people who are fleeing the mainline.
And I think at some point then, if we're upset that our churches are declining, and if really it's not the number of Christians that are declining, which I'd say the question is still open on that a little bit, but if it is the case, you know, we need to know why we're upset that they're there and not here, and we actually need to know why. Like, it can't be because, you know, our culture, it can't be because of our history. It's got to be because we think they could hear the gospel here, they could get the sacraments here, and they're not there. So often it seems to be like a cultural thing.
One interesting thing, back to Rod, to your point about the kind of the individualism and this kind of weird character of American Christianity, colonial, when it starts out. When the fellows came over in 1620, we know that there were no ordained ministers with them. Hmm. We know that in that early, at least that first decade, there were no ordained ministers around. And while that might not trigger anything for us today, what it meant for them is they weren't taking the sacraments because they still had the belief that only that guy got to do the sacraments.
Oh, interesting.
So you're living in a place without that, so you just do without.
And most of them are coming over from Anglicanism, right?
Well, yeah, Anglicanism, and over here they'll become kind of Congregationalists.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so you have this church that's built on a foundation that's sacramental.
Yeah.
And I think when we trace that, and then we start to see what makes this a weird place. Yeah, it lost half of the goods, coming
what's
over.
Steve Paulson's line at Here We Still Stand a couple years ago, America was invented to destroy baptism or something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's worth, worth pointing out, that there was this kind of, we'll do it a different way. And while that may have worked out politically or for various things, innovation isn't what the church really does.
Yeah.
Do it politically.
Not.
Yeah, sure.
What does the earliest days, when you've got these different denominations, if you will, confessions popping up and coming over, what does the relationship look like between them? Is there a lot of polemical exchanges?
Or no, not really.
They all just sort of live alongside of each other?
Their own publishing houses or their own publishers, and they publish for themselves. Mm-hmm. There's no need to read something other people are doing because your guy's publishing mostly the stuff from the old world that you've asked him to bring over. Huh. So
they
we have a lot of
disagree
interesting.
Or
yeah, so we have a lot of records of the books that are coming over.
Mm-hmm.
But the bestsellers are devotional. Mm. The bestsellers aren't the kind of theology that you have disputes over. I mean, insofar as, no, my heart doesn't feel that. Yes, it does. I mean, it's a hard thing to dispute.
Put that into a contemporary context. Believe it or not, Walter Martin used to have this highly successful quote, Sunday school class. And he asked me to sub for him. I said, Walter, you're a card-carrying Southern Baptist with charismatic tendencies. I'm a 16th, 17th century Lutheran. He said, Rod, no problem. People love when you're here. So one morning, I greet a couple who was coming, and I said, we've met before somewhere. And they said, sure, whenever you've been at Bethany Long Beach. I said, could I ask you a question? They said, sure. I said, do you go to the early service at Bethany Long Beach and then come to Walter's Bible class? And they said, yep, every Sunday.
So Bethany Long Beach, which is a Lutheran church, for kind of the liturgy and that, and then over to this Southern Baptist place for the Bible study.
Which proves that with your best laity, if you don't provide really great adult ed, they'll go find it somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that these colonial figures we're looking at are probably this is the most literate society ever, right? I mean, in terms of the people that could make it over, they're people of the book and a book.
Mm-hmm.
And
wasn't it high 90s?
Easy, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is.
Some of the original couple hundred thousand colonists, it was like the high 90s.
So if you look at, people say, this founding generation, how did so many people just come out of this one little generation? Well, they were a dang literate group.
Yep.
They were, education was high up there. They were, you know, biblically literate in a way that, so, I mean, even say the city on the hill, that so many of our things have this religious
yep.
connotation. It sounds, you know, we've got things in state and church that sound similar, and it's because it was all part of their world, and it was much more mushed together.
And it's not just literate in English. It's Latin,
yeah. Yeah.
Greek,
yeah.
and Hebrew. There's a fairly famous diary from some farmer who writes just his day-to-day affairs. He talks about how he gets up in the morning and has, I think it's broiled milk. Then he reads a bit from Homer in the Greek.
Yeah.
Or the next day he's reading something from the Psalms. And
it sounds like my morning.
And then, I mean, it's just real matter-of-fact, kind of drab description, but you're like, what the heck?
Yeah.
And then he talks about, and then I Rogered my wife. And then it goes on. You're like, what the? It's in the diary. It's clean.
Why are you reading diaries?
Well, it's a great way of understanding what people are doing. But yeah, I think of like old-timey people, you know, an old farmer. And yeah. these were by our standards, pretty sophisticated people.
That's interesting.
Very.
And yeah. And so I think sometimes that's another flaw of the historian who will just look back. Well, obviously, they were the unwashed masses.
Yeah. Right? Yes.
They don't understand what we get today.
Illiterate farmers.
Yeah, though he was reading Ovid over breakfast. Mm-hmm, I think he's got the brain cells to work this out. So it's important that we take what we have of them very seriously and look at it and not just assume, oh, it's some half-baked, 17th century idea about religion.
Yeah, even if you read the Federalist Papers or the Anti-Federalist Papers, the biblical allusions were necessary in order to communicate. Yeah.
Hmm. That Montgomery makes that point in his Shaping of America, how mm-hmm. You find all sorts of biblical references, even, of course, amongst the deists and other more secular-minded people. He says, but in order to communicate to Americans, they had to use biblical allusions, whether they believed it
yep,
or
there was
some substance behind it.
Well, all of this kind of comes to a head in 1689, and that's kind of one of the big early years. And this is the year where the Toleration Act is passed in England. And so right, the Glorious Revolution has taken place in England, and they've just gone from Tudors to Stuarts, war, and now they're bringing in William of Orange from the Netherlands. They're going to cool everything out in England. They do for quite some time. That's 1688. 1689, the Toleration Act goes into effect in all the colonies. And this kind of opens the floodgates for all things. And in some ways, it's kind of starts a hysteria, because at this time when we have the dissension laws loosed, everyone can do what they will. And what starts then? The Salem witch trials. This is all of this stuff is 1693. So
tolerance for witches.
Yeah, exactly. Hey guys, let's let everyone do what they want. Whoa, hold on a second. Once again, not that far. And the witchcraft, craze, which was short-lived. It's an interesting story, but, it really, I mean, it shows us, one, some of the hysteria of the age. But interestingly enough, it does actually work itself out that Cotton Mather, the Puritan, he ends up coming to the defense, not only of the women and the one man and the one dog who died, but also, there's 14 women,
not
one man,
dog.
And a dog. He actually came to their defense, and it's been argued that the modern sort of judicial system in America comes out of trying to correct the problems that led to that. Hmm. And it comes out of the Puritans at Harvard. So just another one of those kind of interesting, you think of Mather as maybe an old-timey, Puritan, but he's actually working with the political machinations to do stuff.
Well, cool. So any other, it's not the end of the episode, but any other big names or
themes
that we need to hit before we move on to
founders? I think the idea of the established church is just something to kind of have in your brain, especially when you get to some of the language in the Constitution, the language of the fathers later. The churches after 1689, especially some before, each of the colonies had an established church. You didn't have to go there because this is religious liberty, but they have an established church that tithes go to. Right, that I mean, it's we would think of it as just horribly blending church and state, and these established churches, you can kind of just go around and say, well, Massachusetts, what were they? Congregationalists. Okay, what was, Pennsylvania or Connecticut? Anglican, and it was this relationship between church and state, which I just don't think we know. That's what happened in America. And as a matter of fact, after the Constitution was ratified, after the Bill of Rights was ratified, Massachusetts still had an established church.
Yeah. For decades.
Until the 1830s. Mm-hmm. People were still paying their taxes, and it was going to this denomination. Yeah. So it really shows you that the change that we made, it wasn't like just out of nowhere. I mean, it comes right in this context of everything that's happening.
I've always quoted on church state, the idea I got was we're not going to reestablish what we had in England where there's an American Christianity. The answer is no. But that may be naive on my part.
Well, I think American Christianity, we said we don't want English Christianity.
Right.
Interestingly, American Christianity really waits until 19th, 20th century. Right? Mm-hmm. And there is an American Christianity. But they didn't want the colonies as a whole to be stamped with one denomination.
Right.
But if the colonies themselves, the states themselves, said this is what we want to do, well, their reading of the Constitution said, well, they can do that.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's marvelous. And that's
just an interesting point.
Does the end of that type of thing come in with some of the immigration that brings in a lot more religious pluralism
Absolutely.
Into the states?
Yeah. In the 1830s, when all this ends, you see the uptick of Irish and Italian.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the first wave of kind of anti-immigrant yeah. fever or what have you in America. And so a lot of things are, the population is far too diverse to yeah. say, you know, essentially this colony or this state.
Well, and eventually even some Chinese immigration that's somewhat significant.
Yeah. West Coast first and then a little bit into Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is the kind of crazy place to see all the people come together and try to have to figure it out. And they actually did not a bad job.
Oh, great. We're up at time if you want, Dan. There's some freedom here. Were there any books or anything that people might be familiar with or should know about?
Sure. Yeah, no, in terms of books, Adam, you could help me with this. There's a guy, Gordon Wood, who's got a lot of little books that kind of deal with revolutionary topics. I know that's a little bit more of the next class. Dearmon McCulloch's book, Christianity.
The
first 3,000 years. Justo Gonzalez, Christianity.
I forget the author, Churching of America just focuses in on the American Christianity from the earliest days.
And they deal a little bit with the colonial era, but one of the names you can always go to is Mark Knoll, N-O-L-L.
Yeah. Yes, on anything.
He knows his stuff. George Marsden is another guy who's written a lot on kind of theological history. And that's one of the things just in terms of looking at books is, there are a lot of people, there are a lot of different ways and different lenses people are going to look at the founding and the colonies. And so don't just assume every book is going to deal with their theological positions. So it does you well to kind of look inside.
Well, I think Dr. Montgomery's The Shaping of America is worth adding.
Shaping of America, and that's on 1517?
Yeah. Yep.
Roger Fink, Rodney Stark, these are the names you're talking about, mm-hmm. Adam?
Yeah.
But as we go through this series, I'll make a list of just some of the ones that are just really basic, and help out, though. So it's probably worth saying that we're going to later talk about the Great Awakenings, and we're going to mush the Great Awakening 1 and Great Awakening 2 together.
One.
Great Awakening, the first Great Awakening, took place before the Constitution, after the colonies were kind of settled, right? So go 1730 to 1770s. And that's the first Great Awakening. The names there are Whitfield and Edwards and the Wesleys, and you can... And we're going to talk about them later, but just so you know when they're existing, mm-hmm. it's right in this little pocket. And we'll pick them up later when we get to the 18th century a little bit more and the other Great Awakening.
Well, cool. Well, I think that basically sums up this episode. Thank you, Dan, for walking us through this. It's been a lot of fun. I like being able to sort of have some of the pressure off and just ask somebody else questions.
I will say, although I'm not doing American history, it's church history, the almanac that I do, Christian History Almanac, is kind of the same. It's kind of stories. And hopefully if you dig this kind of story, I do it every day, 7 days a week, give you two stories in the morning. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us on this episode. If you've enjoyed past series or you're really looking forward to this and you'd like to support our podcasting endeavors, you can go to 1517.org. There's a donate button up at the top. We really do rely on people's donations to the network in order to continue to produce content like this. So we really do appreciate those of you who do support us. And if you aren't yet, I would ask you to please consider doing so. All right. Thank you for this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.